Welcome back to another episode of the HR Leaders Podcast, the show where we explore the future of work with industry experts and HR executives from the world's leading global brands. Today we have a very special guest on the show. We're joined by Vidya Krishnan, who's the Global Chief Learning Officer at Ericsson. Welcome to the show, Vidya. How are you?
I am great. Thanks so much for having me. It's really, really great to be here.
Fantastic. Wait, where are you tuning in from?
From sunny Richardson, Texas, USA.
Nice. As hot as it is in the UK, I'm sure it's probably hot.
Yeah, as the day wears on, it gets pretty hot, but the morning is quite nice and bearable. So.
Fantastic. Before we jump in, tell everyone a little bit more about yourself personally and your journey to where we are today.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. First of all, I love the podcast. I'm a fan, so it's great to be here. And I think what I want you to know about me is I feel very fortunate to be part of a great company with a great team that cares a lot about how learning is really all about creating people in the world that are so future focused and that can thrive in their lives. I myself feel like I'm in my fourth career being in this role. I started out in life as a camp counselor with kids. Then I was an engineer. Then I worked as a learning leader in a sort of entrepreneurial capacity within Ericsson. And now I get to be, you know, part of this team that's building skill sets and mindsets that are future focused. And I love this work. So I think probably I'm a geek at heart. But this is for me, you know, this is such an important time in the world for all of us to be doing this kind of work. I feel like learning and reskilling have really emerged, especially in the aftermath of this pandemic, as these forces that can literally unite us in the service of a better world. So it feels like a really important time to be doing this work, and we're really grateful for that.
And we've seen that. We're talking about the Edelman Trust Barometer before the show, right? And the research that came out of that, which was pretty amazing. For everyone that hasn't seen that, go and check it out. And the fact that obviously people look to their organizations, right, for direction and insights. And you also mentioned something else, which I...
Why are they looking to their organizations for that trust? The Edelman Trust Barometer 2020 report says that about something like 58%, like 6 out of 10 employees worry about losing their jobs because specifically of a lack of skills and training. So when you have, you know, 3 out of 5 people worried about that, you better believe that it is the companies, you know, that are holding the trusts of these people to, you know, enable them to reskill and reinvent themselves in ways that enrich their lives and grow the company. So I definitely feel that responsibility, you know, that the Trust Barometer uncovers for us, that this is so top of mind for people and the pandemic has only intensified it. They are looking to their companies for the direction on how to reinvent themselves, what to become, what to unlearn. It's up to us to provide that and up to them to make it happen with us.
It's such a huge feat. You know, we're over nearly 100,000 employees, 108 countries. How do you go about creating a culture and an ecosystem that can help your employees continuously reinvent themselves?
I think the first thing is to recognize that our employees want to. The mission of our culture is not to create the want. They already have it. I think that's a very human urge, right? To continually want to better yourself and improve yourself. And so the hunger is already there. What we believe we have to get right is how we create the conditions in which that constant reinvention and resilience building can happen. And like you kind of said, it's for us, it comes down to 3 things. We've got to build an ecosystem that really makes it easy to go about pursuing that reinvention, that makes it more accessible than ever, that democratizes learning like never before. That's the first thing. The second thing is the culture system. And for us, we talk about our company being Ericsson on the Move. And this cultural foundation for us of valuing things like executing in a speedy way, retaining that humanness and empathy, being courageous and fact-based in the decision-making, creating a culture where people can speak up. This for us is the foundation of our culture system, how we also use that and analytics to be able to differentiate who's learning, who's growing, who's helping other people grow. How do we make sure that we drive learning by celebrating the people who are teaching and helping others? That's a second huge part. And of course, the third part for us is the business system. When we really embed ourselves strategically with our business leaders, we see what these emerging skill needs are. We see strategies they need to be successful, to make our customers successful. And we know how to be proactive rather than reactive in making sure that the directions that we're heading in with our people are things that are showing up in the flow of our work and really driving amazing outcomes for customer experience and employee experience. So for us, Chris, it's those three things. It's ecosystem, culture system, business system. That's how we do it.
Love it. Love it. And one of the things that really stood out to me was, I've heard you say before, building a culture that shows zero tolerance for zero learning.
I've heard it said by so many authors and leaders I admire that, you know, culture is not just what you advocate. It's what you tolerate. And so it's not enough to talk about aspirational standards. You have to talk about the things you're operationalizing and that you will not allow. And when people understand what's no longer tolerated and what's not allowed, that's when change actually gets mobilized. So I think it came out of that, you know, wanting to really channel that spirit and, you know, zero tolerance for zero learning. We're a technology company, so we think in numbers all the time, and the number zero is a pretty big number, believe
definitely,
it or not.
Definitely, yeah. For everyone who's just tuning in on LinkedIn Live, they're probably reading this title thinking, the role of 5G in enabling the empathy engine. Let's start with, I think people have some idea of what 5G is, but let's talk about the empathy engine, because I love the way you put that. I love the phrase, and I love really what it means to you.
Yep. Well, I mean, 5G, I think most people know what it is. It's really the advent of this new powerful, powerful technology for how not just people, but people and machines can connect. It is going to deliver, you know, bandwidth in the megabits, in the gigabits per second, that's going to enable a whole new definition of connectivity for people and for businesses. It is reshaping industries. The power of 5G is not just in how fast these connections can happen, but how that technology not just connects people, but also can connect sensors and machines to create things like robotic surgery capabilities that we never had before, or intelligent sensing that we never had before, mobile broadband that creates really enhanced user experiences like virtual reality and gaming and so forth, and then also fixed broadband that just creates a new level of connectivity for residences and people in areas that were underserved before. So for us, it's this one thing that's sort of changing everything. But from a learning standpoint, the thing I feel it's changing the most is it's going to enable us to be an empathy engine for each other like never before. And by that, I mean, we know how much empathy is critical to just life on Earth and the future of our world. Being able to have, you know, respect and understanding of these different perspectives through networks that are supercharged and superpowered like this, accessing those perspectives, leveraging them, connecting people so that they're just learning from each other and not just learning from content, all of that becomes possible and powerful like never before. It drives on us, I think, a responsibility that empathy is not just this thing we value. It's not just this thing that we want to have, but it is this thing that we deliberately engineer at scale, thoughtfully, you know, in the things that we build and the ways that we conduct our business. So for me, that's why 5G, it's sort of a watershed moment, I think, for the virtual learning movement, because it allows us to attain digitally this new level of authentic human connection. Mm-hmm. And we have to use that, you know, with great responsibility and care.
Yeah. So, do you think that the current events has leapfrogged that forward as well, with everyone being on lockdown?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think this has been the super turbo fuel for the pace of digital transformation. Yeah. And I think for all of the things that we see struggling in the pandemic, it's amazing to see that the people who are fortunate enough to have strong, consistent digital access in many ways don't have some of the struggles that other people do. They are able to, you know, more easily find new work or to keep working. They're able to have better educational outcomes because so much of the learning has shifted online. So now you start to see this digital inequity that the people who have access are actually able, in many cases, to have more agency over their lives and the quality of their lives than the people who don't. And that, to me, is accelerated in this pandemic. And it shows me the responsibility that industries and governments and society have together to level that playing field and make sure that we don't leave anyone behind when it comes to that kind of access. But absolutely, it's accelerated everything.
You're right. There's a lot of comments on LinkedIn right now, so I just want to grab a few. Sven wanted to ask, he said, would you say that emotional intelligence is the biggest foundation block for all systems? How would you improve people's EQ?
I don't know if it's the biggest block, but it's certainly a tremendous block. It's big. There are many systems that are limited, not by the system's capability, but by the decisions of people about what's important. and what's not. And that really does come down to emotional intelligence. What do you value? Do you see yourself as a know-it-all or a learn-it-all, you know, to quote from Satya Nadella? Do you believe that all voices are equal? Do you create systems that, you know, make equal access for all people, that democratize intelligence rather than, you know, specialize and protect and hoard it? So I think that it is a huge block to many, many systems. How do you improve people's EQ? I think the key is tapping into that part of people that want to improve their own EQ. I think it's very hard for someone else to improve someone's EQ when they don't, they're not open to that change. So I think the first thing is that you have to, through whatever channels you get to be part of, you know, expose people to the kinds of diversities of experiences that make them feel, I do need to change my mindset. I do need to learn more and think differently and be able to do more. I love this quote that great minds think differently. So I think that is a huge part of how you improve people's emotional quotient. It's what you choose to tolerate and what you choose to no longer tolerate. And you know, one of my colleagues, Selena, says, oh, it's what you stand for, what you don't stand for, and who you stand with. I think that's what I would say about how you improve people's emotional quotient.
Mm-hmm. How have you gone about supporting your leaders through this time? You know, for them having to be lead during such disruptive times and times of crisis, many of us, if not most of us, we're not prepared. I can certainly say myself, I struggled. As a CEO of HR leaders leading my team during this, what kind of support and guidance have you provided your leaders, and how have you prepared them?
Yeah, you make a great point. I mean, preparedness in general can only take you so far. There's certain things that we just can't be prepared for. So, you know, we recognize that as well. There's very few people who could ever say truthfully, I was prepared for this. So we know that that's part of just being human, right? That we were not prepared for this in certain levels. I think the biggest way that we've tried to support our leaders is by making it easy for them to get access to each other, to help, to best practices on how to take care of their people, how to take care of themselves, how to get things done in a virtual environment. We have found, for example, that in our company, you know, we're deploying Degreed. More and more of our company are on it. They are using this learning experience platform to access not just content, but community. And we have been able to use this in a really powerful way to say within a day, within 2 days, here's a pathway. And here's everything you need to know about best practices that come in the form of little podcasts like this one, or, you know, actual courses about how you can take care of yourself, how you can take care of your teams, how you can keep the channels of communication open. So I think us being, you know, really proactive, and I think also transparent, to make it easy for our leaders to connect to these resources, but also to connect to one another, share what's working, what's not working. I think that's one of the most important things we've tried to do to, you know, not only take care of our leaders, but tap into their leadership, because they've been doing remarkable things. And that local innovation that they are doing every single day, we want to tap into that and actually spread it around. So we've been supporting them, and they've definitely been supporting us.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, because I know a number of, again, CHROs I'm speaking to are reassessing the different LMS partners right now. They're like, actually, this probably isn't what we needed right now. And why Degreed? But I don't want this to be a sales pitch, but there's so many of these platforms out there, right? And I feel like I want to hear from your perspective as a chief learning officer, why you end up choosing Degreed. Because I think there's so many people that are going to listen right now could benefit from hearing what you value and what's really had an impact on your employees from it.
I think for us, we really were very diligent in doing our homework and really came to the conclusion that Degreed could help us be an empathy engine, because it combines features that we know are powerful. We know from the way people use Facebook that they appreciate getting a feed that's somewhat personalized and tailored to them. We know from the way people use Spotify that they care about having playlists that they can create and playlists that they can tap into, which, you know, are pathways. We know from the way people use Twitter and Instagram that they don't just want to connect to content, but they want to follow people and see what they do and learn what they learn. And, you know, Degreed gave us all of those capabilities that we felt were critical in allowing our employees to come together on this platform and learn not just with each other, but from each other. And that ability to
This episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. Two-thirds of employees have one foot out the door in 2024, and the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
To, you know, further democratize and simplify how people get access to learning. Because before this, I think, you know, people, no matter what you offer in your content library as a corporation, people still are programmed that the first thing they think of is, let me go Google something that I'm looking for. And they miss, you know, all the incredible proprietary stuff that you may have within your company. And so the idea that now with one interface, they could get the kind of powerful search that would return not just the things that are inside the company, but the things that are outside the company. And as we're doing that, we're learning about them. We're learning about their skill profile. We're helping our company take better inventory and self-inventory of their skills and their skill progression. I think those were the reasons that that attracted us to it. And that those are the use cases that are coming out to be the most powerful ones that, that we see.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads on to my next question. One of the key questions that keeps coming up in my community all the time, which I was interested to hear your, is how do we build skills for the future now? Because we've kind of realized we're pretty vulnerable.
Absolutely. I mean, I think first of all, we recognize that employees really are ready to reskill themselves with our help. And so we have to recognize that so much of the drive and the needs come from their firsthand experiences. So to some extent, I think part of this is the way we sense and discover and detect, and maybe we say scout for where and what directions do we need to go in order to reskill. And that is absolutely, you know, the derivative of the business realities that they're facing, the challenges that they're facing in their teams, their realities, being able to sense those and collect those and respond and react and anticipate those. So that's just about, you know, how do we operationalize that kind of sensing and listening? I think the second thing is, you know, how do we then build the shifts, creating not just programs, but really making sure that project-based learning, the things that they do, that reskilling is what happens to you on the way to solving a problem. Reskilling is something that happens to you on as part of onboarding into a project. So I think we feel, and we have a long way to go here, but we feel very strongly that more than just having these sort of global programs that are powerful, they can lay a foundation. But the deepest forms of reskilling will happen because people are doing them on the way to solving problems in the midst of working on their projects. Mm-hmm. And they will get them not just from content and community, but from great teachers, you know, subject matter experts around them who feel responsible for teaching others and creating more of them. So I think that's the shift part. And then the third part is really how do we scale and do this in an agile way. So it's not that we go off into a cave and build a program for a year and come back and, hey, no one needs it anymore, but that we are iterating constantly and taking things that are working locally and cross-pollinating them. And that's, you know, that's about the infrastructure that you use to do that scaling. So for us, it's that three-step model, but extremely iteratively, scout, shift, and scale.
Yeah, I love the way you put along the way, you're learning skills along the way, because that's how I try to explain it to a lot of friends. My friends always say, Chris, you're good at doing all these different things. I'm like, I'm really not, but I learned the skill along the way. You know, if I'm building our website or our podcast or a PC for my team, when I first did anything of those, I was learning the skill along the way and acquiring them as I'm doing it. To solve a problem, exactly. And not only am I having the end result, but I've acquired a skill. So for me, that's like, I'm super excited about that. For me, that's the one reason I'm so passionate about learning is not only am I learning the skill along the way, but then I also have the, I'm like, wow, now here is the result of my hard work.
Yeah.
It's like a drug for me, I'll be honest.
It is a drug. It's unlocking superpowers you didn't know you had. And it's what you do on the way to solving problems. And I think that is the most powerful thing. We recently saw within our own company, these are really super busy people, the opportunity to participate with other companies in the White House on a hackathon around COVID-19. I think the call to action went out at like you know, 6 o'clock on an evening, and by 7 o'clock they're looking for 100 people. By 7 o'clock, things they had 400 people signed up. These are really super busy people. They all signed up.
You're passionate about it, right? Yeah.
Very passionate. It involved data science. It involved things that many of the people who signed up, myself included, did not know enough about. And everyone was just resolved to, I will learn what I need to learn on the way to working on this. I will become whatever I need to become on the way to solving this problem, because we care about solving this problem. So I think that is, you know, to me, that's the heart of reskilling. And Deloitte says it very beautifully. It's beyond reskilling. Reskilling is not the strategic end in and of itself. It's about the resilience of creating a workforce that says, on the way to solving the problems that matter to me, I know I can become whatever I need to be. Yeah. That's what we have to tap into.
Another thing that's come up a lot is the transformation of the learning function itself.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because I have spoke to some CLOs whose learning function means something completely different to, you know, to the others and the organization's perspective, the value that's put on it, the culture. It seems to be many organizations are stuck in the past. Vast majority, actually, unfortunately, I speak to, seems to be stuck in the past. So I'm wondering, how have you seen the learning function evolve? And also on that point, how are you continuously keeping yourself up to date with current events and what's happening as a CLO? Because that's tough. Yep. Such a fast-moving, it's just so fast-moving.
Yeah, maybe I'll answer the second question first, because you just said it. I often think, you know, the L in CLO is not learning, but learner. My job is to continually, part of my job, I think, is to continually be a learner and make sure that I and my team and my whole company, you know, sees our leaders being learners so that we can be learning drivers. And so for me, that means I try very hard to be the student, probably much more than I could ever be the teacher, and making sure people see that, that I'm showing up in courses right next to all of our people and learning right alongside them, that we're never done learning. So I think sometimes I feel our jobs are going to be increasingly characterized by what we don't know and how we handle what we don't know, rather than just how we leverage what we do know. And so I think our job, you know, our new job, if you will, as a CLO, is to be the chief learner officer and really demonstrate a zeal and a constancy in changing ourselves. So I think that is critical. And I try to do that. I'm very lucky, I think, to be surrounded by a lot of people I can learn from, including my family. They remind me every day how much I have to learn. So that's very valuable. But then to go back to your first question of, you know, how do you really move this forward? It is so much about creating the conditions. I think that the identity of L&D is shifting.
Yes.
It is shifting. It is shifting that we have to be this group that creates the conditions for our people to reinvent themselves again and again in ways that enrich their lives and enrich our company. And that is something that goes beyond just learning in its narrow sense and just development in its narrow sense. I think this is a much more broad and, quite frankly, much more strategic place that we have to occupy. We have to be the business partner of choice for all of our people and our teams, to help them solve problems that matter and to create the conditions for people to become what they need to solve those problems. So I think that's how I look at it. And I think the future is almost pulling us in that direction. It's just demanding that this is the role that we play. And we are uniquely capable of playing it because our, you know, unlike many other functions, our work puts us truly in the flow of the daily work that happens. It puts us totally in the lives of our people and their diverse realities. It puts us in a place where we can connect the dots like no one else, where we can build this ecosystem that is an empathy engine like no one else. And therefore, I think that that becomes our new mission. And we are thinking about that every day. We're trying to figure out what is that future state. But we definitely see it as, you know, creating the conditions for people to constantly reinvent themselves in ways that enrich their lives and enrich the company.
It's super exciting.
Like, it's a great thing to look forward to working on, right?
Yeah, like it's just never ending. There's no end goal. It's just a continuous development and evolution. Like that's what I love about learning.
Sometimes in school, one of the things that happens is, and it's not intentional, but I think it does happen, is that the notion of grades and tests and exams,
yeah,
instead of those things serving as feedback to propel you in what direction to go and where to, you know, where to look for more keys to unlock the doors that, you know, lead to learning, sometimes they get construed and even treated as reasons to stop, reasons not to go further in this. I don't think I can do that. These grades and this performance of mine, this comparative grade and this test and all that is showing me what I can't do. When it actually, it's absolutely intended as the opposite. It is meant to unlock how you figure out what unlocks you. And I think that's one of the reasons sometimes that people feel that they do more learning after school than they did in school, because I think there's this sort of emotional impediment that, you know, when you feel scared or intimidated or shamed or self-conscious, your mind can't absorb the things it needs to. But when you sort of get beyond that and you address those emotional needs, your intellectual ones suddenly take over. So I think that's something we really do need to put into the reforms that we're doing in education.
You're right. That was the biggest barrier for me was, you know, demonizes failure.
Yeah.
Whereas I see failure as progress. Now, like, I love it. Like, I'm obsessed. I'm like, the more I'm failing, the better. I have to fail in order to get better. And I realized that playing sports where, you know, for example, ice hockey, I would fall on my face a million times before I could ice skate. Or skateboarding, I would fall over probably more than a million times before I could skateboard. And that was in school, that was seen as a negative. You failed this exam, you failed this, and then you get demotivated. You don't want to carry on. And I realized only after school, I realized that's actually great, because the amount of people that say, I'm just not good at that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how many times have you done it? Oh, I've never done it before. I'm just not good at that stuff. Yeah. What do you mean?
And then you find out that's the difference between success and failure, right? How the appetite people have to try to grow, to see themselves as works in progress versus to conclude, you know, that's not for me and I'm terrible at that. I heard it said once that failure is not fun. It's not. All those falls that you describe, I'm sure they hurt. You know? And you didn't feel like experiencing that pain again. It's not fun, but it's fundamental. And I think that is the shift that we need our people to.
It's not fun,
to
but fundamental.
Yeah, it's not fun. It's not fun. Mm-hmm. As someone who fails often and fast and huge, it's not fun.
But you're smiling about it while you're saying it right now. And that's how I am. I'm like, I
haven't done the next one yet. It's coming. But yeah, between failures, I smile. But absolutely. I think that's just it, right? Mm-hmm. Those failures, in many cases, they have been seismic in my life. You know, the earth shattering. And you definitely need to separate the accountability for progress from the shame at what didn't work.
Yes.
And I think that's the fundamental thing we have to do better as institutions, whether they're companies, as families, as governments, as societies. We have to take the shame out of failure and leave enough room for people to naturally take the accountability for getting better that they would. It's the shame that stops us.
Yeah. One of the questions that a few people have messaged me on LinkedIn in private chat, so they clearly really want an answer to this one. they've skipped the feed and gone straight into my private messages on LinkedIn and said, yeah, I know. A few people asking, you know, how do you measure ROI? Like, how do you measure ROI? That seems to be a common question that keeps coming up right now amongst everyone. So I'm interested to hear that. What does that look like for you?
First of all, we have the same question because we know that the definition of it is sort of continually changing. And for us, it's ROI and it's ROL, right? The return on learning. I think that's a phrase Accenture coined, and they even had a formula for it that, you know, said that for every $1 that you invest in effective competence, they prove that you get like $4.50 back in productivity savings. So right there is your math for, you know, the ROL or the ROI of programs. But I think it's more than that. We definitely feel, you know, again, when you embed reskilling, for example, in projects, the ROI is the effectiveness of how you delivered the work. So it's no different from the business KPIs. You know, did you do it? How was it on time? What was the customer experience? What was the employee experience? Did it make money? Did it make margin? You know, how many did it conform? Did the user acceptance testing go well? How many defects did we find? You know, how many of the user stories were we able to deliver, you know, in our agile sprint? So I think for us, the key is to embed the learning in a way that the business outcome ROIs become the ROIs for learning. Because definitely there are separate ROIs that we do care about, right? We care about personas and what they think and how much would you recommend this experience to other people and how valuable are you finding it and so forth. But I think by and large, we know that those are maybe, you know, secondary metrics in the service of the primary ones, which are the business metrics. And so I still keep coming back to, we definitely need to mature in our analytics capability. We need to be able to see that business impact, not just at the end of a project, you know, turning around and looking at what's already finished, but in the flow, looking at metrics that are not just rear facing, but somewhat, you know, pre-indicative metrics of what's to come, and using those metrics to say, when we deliver a project and when I, maybe as a business owner, am delivering my profit and loss, when I stand up in front of you at a business review and I show you, here are my results, here's the money I made, here's the margin I made, here's the quality of service for the customer. If I also don't stand up and show you the skill shift that my team accomplished doing that, then I have just given you an incomplete business review. And if all of those indicators are green, but my skill shift is red, I didn't have a good quarter. I think that's the shift that we are after. And when you do that, then the ROI of learning absolutely is simply, you know, the ROI of the business investments that you're making.
Love it. I'm so glad I asked that question now. And I think you
we're asking too. We don't have the answer. This is just what we think the answer is in that direction. But, you know, we're after the same thing.
No, it makes sense. What are the most common questions that you get from, just out of curiosity, the business leaders now? Have you had a lot of much more business leaders kind of flooding into your email inbox given the current event, saying, Vidya, how do we, you know, what do we do right now with everyone working remotely? Is that increased the work you do? And just out of interest.
First of all, I think the thing I'm proudest of is it's not people showing up in your inbox. They're literally like standing virtually, at least side by side. They're on live meetings with you, and you got a whiteboard open, and they're telling you what they think. So there's not an inbox transaction. It's like, okay, let's talk about this right now, which I love because it just shows that the passion is not just within our function, right? The passion to really make learning a strategic part of the business is coming from the business. So, you know, it's our moment to not waste, and it's our opportunity to, you know, to not miss. So I think definitely, but their questions, you know, to your point, what are they asking? Their question, how can you be more strategically involved upfront so that the strategy we are setting is not just a portfolio strategy or product strategy, but it is also a people strategy about how we're going to shift our workforce to create the capabilities to deliver that solution and to do it in that way and to, you know, satisfy that customer value proposition that we've got. So that's the first and foremost thing. How can we have you know, more strategically immersed in our business so that you are not listening and reacting to us, but you are literally sitting there sort of advising and co-owning and sensing what's needed and then co-creating that with us. So I think if I had to, you know, bucketize all the questions that I get most often, they're all of that nature. We don't want the model where you know, come with the list and we give it to you, or you know, we fill out the list and you're reacting. Like, we know that we want you sitting next to us at the table, not on the other side. Yeah. Not as a consultant that is a little bit separated from the work, but as a coach or a consultant that's in the flow of our work, sitting on the same side of the table, saying, what's the line of sight between these strategic outcomes and how we enable the skill shifts in our team to make them happen? And not just the skill shifts, but the experiential learning and putting it in the flow of the projects, putting it in the flow of the onboarding to actually make those business outcomes happen. That's by and large the number one thing we get.
Well, that's a testament to the culture of learning you've built, you know, because learning doesn't fit with a learning function, right? It sits with every leader, every employee within the organization. The responsibility is not for Vidya and the team. It's for everyone. In the organization. And I wish I could say that was common in most companies that I speak to.
But we don't look at it like we're there. We have it, you know, going on, and it's for us too, we don't believe that we're there yet. You know, we believe that it's just this thing that it's work that's never done. But we definitely feel that there is a shift in our culture where it's becoming much more explicit that if a leader is not a learning driver, then that leader is not good enough. And we are ready to say that. And make it happen. And we believe that, you know, we see that, you know, we see that the teams that are delivering the best outcomes, business outcomes, just happen to be the ones that have, you know, the best, most active peer and team learning culture, where the manager is demonstrating, not only is he making it safe, or she making it safe for people to learn, but is actively him or herself demonstrating being a student all the time. And the team is going on a learning journey, not just the individual, but the team is taking some responsibility for what do we need to become at the end of the year. So you're not just doing your goal setting individually, you're doing it as a team. And the goal includes that skill shift. And you know, we don't see enough of that, but we are starting to see very clearly there's just an undeniable correlation between the teams where that happens and the teams with the best results. So that becomes a new paradigm for leadership. If you're not doing these things, you're not doing it, you're not good enough.
Mm-hmm. And that only just kind of compounds, you know, when each of those employees become a leader, that's again now part of the culture of their leadership, and because that's what they came from, and that's and it kind of just kind of blooms from there. So it's like super exciting.
If you define a leader as someone with followers, which you know I get from this beautiful book of by Marcus Buckingham and Ashley Goodall, but Nine Lies About Work, they talk about, you know, leaders are people with followers. Why would people follow you? They will follow you because they believe and trust that you have a genuine empathy for how they get better and how they reinvent themselves.
Look, before I wrap up, I'm conscious of time. I feel like I could talk to you forever. You're incredible. But I'm going to jump into our quick fire round. I'm going to ask you 5 questions. Wow. And you have no longer than 30 seconds to give us some amazing answers.
5 questions, 5G. Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Yes.
What was the number one thing that was holding you back from becoming a senior learning leader in your field?
I never felt there was anything holding me back.
And how did I know that was going to be your answer? Because you're, because again, given everything we've discussed, that's just part of your DNA and the culture.
I think I've been also very fortunate. I mean, in every job, it was never about a level for me. It was just wherever we were, you know, if this was passionate, you could act a lot. Yeah.
Love it. What's the best piece of business advice you've ever received?
Pay really, really close attention to the newest people, the ones who you could easily look at and say, oh, they don't know as much as everyone else, and therefore, you know, they're not as valuable as everyone else. Never forget what it's like to be the person that doesn't know, the person that's totally new, the person that's totally uncertain. If you can make that person feel empowered and special, then your whole team will feel that way, and they will do work that is beyond your wildest dreams if you just tap into their strengths, their talents, their passion, and create the opportunity for them every day to combine those talents and passions. TOP. If you create that TOP and never forget what it's like to be scared and create that psychological safety, mm-hmm. your teams will surpass and amaze you every time. And that has been true in my life.
Amazing. And we all know that feeling of being that new person.
Good feeling. Scary and good.
Everyone can relate to that. What's one book, or actually some books, that you'd recommend to our audience, and why? Because I know you've probably got more than one book given.
Very much. It just so happens I have one literally within reach, which is Frederic Laloux's Reinventing Organizations. This is one that's made a tremendous impact on how I think about what the future of, you know, people at work is going to look like, you know, what society needs, about how people come together and get work done, how it's about creating wholeness in the workforce. So that one is a huge one. Believe it or not, as an engineer, a book that's shaped my thinking is The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande. And he talks so powerfully about just human consciousness and how we tend to, we're really good at complex things, and we tend to not be so good at the mundane. And so when we really want to create, you know, amazing outcomes, we got to make sure people wash their hands with soap. Mm-hmm. And how important it is to have systems that make those things easy and don't tolerate not doing them if you want to create a workforce that's equipped to go focus on the really complex higher level stuff. I read that book at a very dark time in my life when we had made a huge failure and it was not fun. And we were figuring out how to recover from that and do right by our customers. And that book in many ways changed my thinking about, you know, how to get better and how to tap into our own power to create predictable high quality outcomes in a crazy dynamic changing world. So mm-hmm. small book, but a big impact on my life.
Love it. We'll definitely include them in the description for everyone. Yeah. What about online resources? What's in the web browser? Sort of what are your go-to sort of websites for learning, for your own personal learning?
Everything through Degreed. So definitely, I love the Degreed has this amazing Chrome extension so that whatever I'm reading, whether it's an article or anything, I can literally click this little button on my browser and flip it into a pathway and read it later and know that I read it and share it with people in Degreed.
Cool. It's so you just click whatever you want, browser. It goes in.
Yeah, nice. You use their Chrome extension. It's fantastic. So that thing is changing my life. So I do a lot of reading from that. It's everything you can imagine. I read everything I can get my hands on. I'm a big Flipboard fan that aggregates news from all these different places.
Yep.
I love doing that. I'm a big fan of course, I read all the great research coming out from, Deloitte and Human Capital Trends and McKinsey and all those things. But I also read things about, from Sounds True, it's a company I admire very much, about wholeness and creating, purpose-filled lives and respecting empathy and cultivating, tranquility. So I'm all over them. I'm as divergent or as you said you were.
No one surprised by this, really. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. And last but
I'll
not
read
least,
anything.
But it's good to get a diverse perspective, right? Even I'm even looking at things that I completely disagree with.
Yes.
Just to make sure I'm getting a different perspective. I'm not always, like we spoke about before the show, obviously just getting fed the same information that you see over and over again, because that's how the algorithms are designed on many platforms as well. So it's super important to make sure you're intentional about your learning as well. So
And I love Audible. I love people reading books to me. It's maybe I flashback to bedtime stories or something, but I love that. So.
I'm obsessed with Audible as well. And I'm not sure you know, but they reached out to me this week and they've actually just launched a B2B play. They've probably reached out to you, of course. But more, they're like, "Yeah, we want to speak with CHROs and CLOs, Chris. We want to integrate Audible into their LMS." I was like, "Oh, cool!" "Why am I so excited about this?" I was like, "I love Audible as well." So
it's gonna sound crazy, but in this pandemic, I don't commute anymore, and it's not that I ever loved my commute. But that is also when I would listen to the books. So
yeah, me too. Exactly.
Now I only can do it when I'm doing laundry. It's just not as fun. So.
But last question. I just realized the last one. What's one thing about your business that you're most excited about?
We are building the future. And I think we're building the future of work. And I think we are helping to build the tools and the conditions that the future workforce is going to use. And the fact that we are building the things that unleash the power of connectivity seems like precisely the thing the world needs right now to solve its most pressing problems and its most pressing inequities. So the fact that we are so much a part of technology for good is the thing that I'm most excited about and most proud of.
Yeah, fantastic. We'll certainly come across throughout today's show, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to see you. When I looked at my diary today and I saw we're speaking, I was so, so excited. for everyone on LinkedIn, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us as well for your own learning today. we appreciate that. Vidya, if anyone wants to connect with you, reach out, say hello, where's the best place for them for them to do so?
LinkedIn works, and vidya.krishnan@ericsson.com.
fantastic. Well, I'll let you go, get on with your day, have a good, great weekend.
Thank you,
and I'll see you again soon. Okay,
all right, best wishes everyone, thanks again.